From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. NPR's Backseat Book Club returns this fall with another reading adventure. As you may recall, this is when we choose a book for 9 to 14-year-olds, and we ask our listeners, young and not quite so young, to read along with us. Our colleague Michelle Norris tells us about this month's selection.
Now that we're back in the saddle, we've reached back in history to find a book that will delight adults as well as all those kids between the ages of 9 and 14. For this month, we read a classic, Black Beauty. Generations of children and adults have loved this book, and it's easy to see why. Rarely does a story tug at the heart in quite this way. It's the tale of a majestic ebony-colored horse whose life stretches from the green pastures of the English countryside to the teeming streets of London. And you view that world through the horse's eyes. He's the narrator. And what you see and hear in his voice reveals much about both human nature and animal suffering.
I must stand up in a stable night and day, except when I'm wanted. And then I must be just as steady and quiet as any old horse who has worked 20 years. Straps here and straps there, a bit in my mouth and blinkers over my eyes. Now, I am not complaining, for I know it must be so. I only mean to say that for a young horse, full of strength and spirits, who has been used to some large field or plain, where he can fling up his head and toss up his tail and gallop away at full speed, and then round and back again with a snort to his companions, I say it's hard never to have a bit more liberty to do as you like.
As his name suggests, Black Beauty was prized for his size and his strength. He spends his youth galloping freely in green meadows, but when misfortune comes, he's sold to a series of owners and lands in the grime of London.
The first week of my life as a cab horse was very trying. I had never been used to London, and the noise, the hurry, the crowds of horses, carts and carriages that I had to make my way through made me feel anxious and harassed.
Along the way, he meets a series of horses whose stories are like a soap opera that could be called Beast of Burden. There's Peggy, who's often whip. She's just too slow. Ginger is temperamental, but for good reason. Rory is injured in an accident and sent away to haul coal. Black Beauty was written by Anna Sewell and first published in England in 1877. To better understand how Sewell's book became both a children's classic and an animal rights manifesto, we turn to Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Jane Smiley.
She loved to drive the family pony, and she loved to talk to the pony as if the pony could understand her. Probably Black Beauty is based on a horse named Bess that they had, who was quite beautiful and black and very spirited and willing, and everybody in the family was quite fond of her.
Jane Smiley has read Black Beauty many times. She herself rides and grooms horses. She says the way horses were mercilessly overworked and yet both prized and underappreciated is the emotional thread in this book. But to understand why Black Beauty had such a strong impact, Smiley says you have to remember how horsepower fueled 19th century England.
It's almost impossible for us to understand, I think, now that we have motorized vehicles, all the things that horses did. They went down in coal mines. They carried large amounts of goods over long distances. Anything that had to be moved, no matter how heavy it was moved by a horse. They just performed every function in society. And so they were seen as vehicles and utility animals, and society couldn't function without them.
The little green book with the sad-looking horse on its cover was an immediate sensation in England. Promoters brought a pirated edition of the book to America, hoping it would, in part, do for animal rights what Uncle Tom's Cabin had done for slavery. Within 2 years, 1 million copies of Black Beauty were in circulation in the U.S. Smiley says the book did change perceptions, but she suggests another factor was also at work.
Some things go out of fashion, and there's a correlation, but not necessarily a causation. But the irony of it is that the best thing that ever happened to horses was that they ceased to be the automobiles and trucks of their day. The automobile was invented, and horses became pets, companion animals, leisure animals. And so, in general, they became better treated. They no longer had to do the things that they had had to do all through the 19th century. So it took about a generation or a generation and a half for horses to be supplanted by motorized vehicles. So yes, Black Beauty had an effect, but technology had probably a bigger effect.
Is it an overstatement to say that the book in some way paved the way for animal rights movements and institutions like the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals?
I don't think it's an overstatement. I think that Black Beauty helped people see animals in a new way. As soon as you say that an animal has a point of view, then it's very difficult to just go and be cruel to that animal. The greater analogy, I think, is when, with the rise of the novel, when women started being portrayed in the novel as having inner lives and points of view and opinions, then the idea of what women were for in society began to shift. And that had only happened in the 18th century with books like Pamela and Clarissa. So to give a woman a point of view, to give a slave a point of view, to give a horse a point of view, all of these things show to readers that the world is full of beings who should not be treated like objects.
If you pick up this book, it will probably touch some emotion. It may make you cry. And yet we give this book to children time and time again. This is very much a children's book.
Children love very clear moral choices, and they love the knowledge that danger will somehow be overcome. That's a feature of children's literature. And Beauty does come to a good end. He finds a place where he's taken care of and happy. So that's kind of what we expect in a children's book, a happy ending.
And really, don't we all want a happy ending? I'm Michelle Norris.
That was Jane Smiley talking with our own Michelle Norris about Anna Sewell's classic novel, Black Beauty.
For NPR's next Backseat Book Club, we've picked a modern-day bestseller, The Red Pyramid by Rick Riordan. You can send questions for the author to backseatbookclub@npr.org or tweet us at NPR Backseat.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Dashiell Hammett's The Thin Man invented a new kind of crime fiction. It was hard-boiled, but also lighthearted, funny, with a hint of homicide. Nick and Nora Charles and Asta, their wire-haired terrier, were rich, witty, and in love when America was in the middle of the Depression.
They can expect a woman to still have any mystery left for a man after living in a place like this for 3 days? I don't know.
Darling, you don't need mystery. You've got something much better, something more alluring.
What?
Me.
You.
They also drank a lot. Nick and Nora, not Asta, though he got an occasional leftover slurp. The Thin Man was made into a popular motion picture starring William Powell and Myrna Loy and a wire-haired terrier, which spawned 5 sequels, including After the Thin Man and Another Thin Man. And although the screenwriting couple of Albert Hackett and Frances Goodrich usually completed the screenplays, MGM Studio needed the stories and characters that only Dashiell Hammett could write. Now, for the first time, the stories of After the Thin Man and Another Thin Man have been published as novellas. The Return of the Thin Man. They've been edited by Richard Lehman, who joins us now from the studios of SCETV in Columbia, South Carolina. Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Where have these stories been?
They've been in my file cabinet since 1981, roughly. Before that, they were in the archives at the legal office of MGM in Culver City.
Tell us about these writing contracts that Hammett would get from MGM. I don't know if that kind of thing is done anymore in Hollywood.
After The Thin Man was first produced in 1934 by MGM, but it was a B-movie. It was done on a $250,000 budget, and MGM expected it to be just another of the, you know, six-week wonders that they routinely produced. In fact, the movie was a big success. It was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. And it made the studio a lot of money, so they decided immediately that they needed a second story in the series. They didn't have the talent to do it in-house, they didn't believe, so they went to Hammond.
Let's try and set this up, the story, because once again in this story, Nick Charles and Nora have sworn off crime-solving. But they come home to San Francisco, find a body, and get dragged back in. What happens?
Well, Nick Charles is always reluctantly pulled into a murder. This time, the murder has associations with Nora's family, so he can't back away from it.
Let's hear a reading from After the Thin Man.
They arrive at the house and they go up the front steps. Nora, last one in bed is a sissy. They run into the house pulling off clothes. From the living room to meet them come Asta and the reporters they left at the Hall of Justice. The reporters asking questions. Do the police suspect Mrs. Landis? What connections did Pedro Dominguez have with the Landis killing? Etc., etc. Nick insists he knows nothing about it and has nothing to say as they go back into the living room, winding up with, I'm going to give you boys one drink apiece and then put you out. One of the reporters asks, well, answer another question for us, and we won't print it if you don't want us to. Is it true that you actually didn't retire as a detective, but are working undercover? Nick, starting to pour drinks. No, it's not true, but don't print it, because I don't want my wife's relatives to know I'm living on her money.
What do you learn by working with Hammett Words about Hammett dialogue?
Oh, Hammett was a master of dialogue, and that was why it was so important to MGM. You know, when Hammett was first attracted to Hollywood, he heard the first talkie and he knew that the talents that he had were in demand in Hollywood, and indeed they were. You know, Hollywood had gone from a formula by which action advanced a plot in the days of the silent movies to a formula in which dialogue and character advanced the plot. And the two things that Hammett did superbly was develop character and write dialogue.
Were the screenplays, the stories that he wrote, darker than the movies that got made out of it?
In some respects, they were darker. But the big difference that you see between the Hammett story and the produced movie has to do with the drinking and the sexuality, but especially the sexuality. It was a time in which the Motion Picture Association had developed the Code of Decency. Mm-hmm. A character named Joseph Breen was the appointed censor. When he saw Hammett's scripts, he must have had fits of apoplexy.
Say, how many drinks have you had?
This will make 6 martinis.
All right. Will you bring me 5 more martinis?
Nick Charles drank from morning till midnight and seemed to grow more charming and clever with each sip. Was that true of Dashiell Hammett?
It was indeed. You know, there was a famous photo session of all of the former writers for Black Mask magazine. Raymond Chandler was also a Black Mask writer. In this photo that was made in, 1935, 1936, one of the only known photos of Hammett and Chandler together. Afterwards, Chandler wrote to someone saying that Hammett had had at least 12 drinks during the time that they were together and didn't show the least effect from them.
And so that's a quality he with which he invested Nick Charles.
Yes, it was. Nick Charles is in many respects like Hammett, just as Nora is in many respects like Hammett's girlfriend, Lillian Hellman, yeah, to whom The Thin Man, the published book, is dedicated.
Mm. Why did the studio eventually get tired of Dashiell Hammett?
The studio got tired of him for 2 reasons, I think. First of all, because of his, quote, irregular habits.
Irregular habits meant regular drinking?
Regular drinking. He had a reputation for not showing up at the appointed time, often because he was drunk, sometimes because he'd been out partying all night and just didn't feel like getting out of bed. But more important than that, Hammett was at that time becoming politically active, and he was involved in the Screenwriters Guild, a unionization effort of the screenwriters to force the studios to give the writers credit and money for the work that they did.
Had he also been at least briefly a communist?
No, it wasn't briefly. It was a long-term commitment. He was a member of the Communist Party, card-carrying. He apparently joined the party in about 1935, at about the time he was, just before the time he was writing After the Thin Man. And he remained a member of the party, for the next, two decades.
How did he grow to feel about this franchise that he'd created?
I think he was fed up with Nick and Nora Charles. Not fed up. He was tired of them pretty early on, and he was fed up with the studios for the exploitation of the characters that he saw. Just before he finished the last draft for Another Thin Man, MGM bought all rights to the characters, Nick and Nora Charles and Asta, so that they could develop the series without him. They paid $40,000 for those character rights. And Hammett wrote to Lillian Hellman just after that, there may be better writers than I am, but nobody ever created a more insufferably smug set of characters than the Charleses, and they can't take that away from me, even for $40,000.
Richard Lehman. He's edited two stories by Dashiell Hammett featuring the beloved characters Nick and Nora Charles and their little dog, Asta. They're published under the title The Return of the Thin Man. Richard, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You made any New Year's resolutions?
Not yet. Any complaints or suggestions?
Few. You don't scold, you don't nag, and you look far too pretty in the mornings.
All right, I'll remember. Must scold, must nag, mustn't be too pretty in the mornings.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Joe Queenan has written 9 books. He's written about everything from Closing Time, a memoir about his own difficult childhood in a Philadelphia housing project, to Imperial Caddy, the rise of Dan Quayle in America and the decline and fall of practically everything else. Throw in columns for the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and GQ, umpteen newspaper articles, appearances on The Daily Show. It is a prolific career, and surprisingly so, surprising, because Joe Queenan reads so much, you've got to wonder when he has time to write anything. His new book is about reading. It's called One for the Books, and Joe Queenan joins us now from New York. Welcome to the program once again.
Thank you for having me.
You start by calculating how many books you read and how many you've read. What's the current rate and what's the count up to?
I think I've read between 6,000 and 7,000 books. I read about 100 books a year on a slow year, 120, 130 most years, and then some years I've just gone completely nuts. A couple years ago, I read about 250. I was trying to read a book every single day of the year, but I kind of ran out of gas.
Yes, and this huge part of your waking life, it's escapism, it's passion, it's addiction, it's a personality disorder. How do you describe what it is?
I think people who read an enormous number of books are basically dissatisfied with the way things are going on this planet. And I think, in a way, people read for the same reason that kids play video games, is they like that world better. It works better. It's more exciting. And it usually has a more satisfactory ending. But it is an obsession. If you're just kind of touched in the head in the way that I am, where you're constantly reading 60, 70 books simultaneously, constantly organizing my weeks, my days, my months around how I'm going to read books, the order that I'm going to read them in. I guess the ordinary person doesn't do that, but I think there are quite a few people out there who are somewhat similar to me.
I think we can stipulate about the ordinary person not.
They read about one book a year, and it's by Tom Clancy or James Patterson. They read books. The average person reads books by people who didn't write the books that they're reading. They got someone to write them for them. So,
now, you don't discriminate here between high literary efforts and, let's say, well-executed pulp fiction. There's a place for that as well in your reading.
Yeah, especially when you're young, because when you're young, you're not going to start reading Jane Austen or Dostoevsky. You start out reading people like, in my case, Agatha Christie. I read all the Agatha Christie novels when I was young, and I really enjoyed them. And when you go back to read them later, they don't hold up as well because she's not really a great writer. But you move on, and they open the door for you. And I've always liked reading mysteries. I love reading Simenon's books, which are just fantastic books. I love the Arthur Conan Doyle books. But lately, I'm less likely to read sort of beach reading or trash. If I'm going to read something bad, I want to read something that's really, really, really bad.
For example?
All of these books that are about what if Helen of Troy actually didn't go to Troy, or it was her double, or she only went to Troy because she wanted to get this mysterious scepter. Those books are so dumb. And I call them Loins of Telemachus books, and I love them because they're so spectacularly dumb. Self-published books are great. Self-published books are so addled, and they just go off into the most insane. They always have ghosts. They always have ghosts, like the ghost of a deer goes into a composer's head and becomes a serial killer. And there's no editor to say, you really want to tone this down. They're just, I get them all the time. People send them to me, and they're just insanely bad books. And those are a hoot.
But you read them. You go ahead and you read them.
I read them, but I read them real fast.
Okay. As a lover of books, we might expect you to be fond of, or at least have strong opinions about, bookstores, book clubs, libraries. Which ones get thumbs up from you?
Libraries kind of depress me. And part of it is because you know that you can't read all of the books that they have. But a lot of it is because libraries used to have some kind of way of putting the kind of Graham Greene and Charles Dickens and Jane Austen and Charlotte Bronte stuff in one category. And then they'd have like Duff and DeMaria and people. But they wouldn't have the actual trash mixed in. And now it's just all one big maw. And it's kind of depressing because most of the books that you see on the library shelves are terrible books.
Bookstores?
You know, I look like a cop. You know, I'm Irish and I'm big guy, gray hair. You know, and I just, as soon as I walk into a bookstore, the people, the irony boys who work in bookstores, they just always figure, what's he doing here? He's looking for a book about Roger Maris breaking the home run record or something. And they just don't like me. They just don't. When I was in Paris when I was 21, I used to go to Shakespeare and Company. And you always hear these great stories about what a wonderful place that was. They were horrible to me. I mean, they didn't even – they could tell. Most of the people who would go in there, they were poorly shod. They looked like they hadn't eaten in a long time. They looked like they were at death's doorstep. So you knew that they'd gone to Phillips Exeter. You knew that they'd gone to Andover. Whereas I was just – I was like a Catholic, you know, Irish Catholic kid from Philadelphia. And I just didn't look like I was ever going to grow up to be Richard Brautigan or Paul Auster or any of those people. So my experiences in bookstores have been varied.
Book clubs?
They're just stupid. They're just ridiculous. I mean, my problem with book clubs, part of it is like one week they discuss something like Anna Karenina and War and Peace, and the next week they discuss the stupidest book imaginable. They just discover whatever book, you know, Anita Shreve just happened to write or something like that. And it's like, there's no theme to your pudding here. And the other thing is that when I read books, particularly when I read, like you read Oscar Wilde or you read Moliere or particularly Shakespeare, I would consider it an invasion of their privacy for me to express any opinion about their work. The market has spoken. There's nothing that we can add to this conversation. And somebody once said about Emily Dickinson, the correct way to approach Emily Dickinson is on your knees.
Can you just, very briefly, can you just explain the joy, not just of reading, but of rereading, which is something that some people can do and some people just can't abide.
If you can listen to Beethoven's Fifth Symphony or his Ninth Symphony over and over and over again and still get this amazing rush from it, you can do exactly the same thing with a book. So books that I love, like I love The Stranger. I love The Sun Also Rises. I love Pride and Prejudice. I love a bunch of books by Thomas McWane. Just really love them. Bushwhacked Piano. Just go back and read those books over and over and over again. And it's a pleasure that just keeps repeating. Part of it is because we forget things. I just reread Madame Bovary. Mm-hmm. And there were all sorts of things that I had forgotten. And one of the things that I had forgotten was how funny it is. And I probably read Madame Bovary 5 or 6 times.
Well, Joe Queenan, thanks a lot for talking with us. It's been great fun.
Thank you.
Joe Queenan's new book is called One for the Books. You can find a list of Joe Queenan's best books ever read or written at our website, npr.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
As baby boomers and their parents age, we're getting more and more essays and books written about the test of endurance that adult caretaking demands. Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Russo began his adventure of looking out for his mother early in life. In his new memoir, Elsewhere, Russo writes not only of his mother, but of the vanished world that shaped her. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
Something must have been in the tap water in Gloversville, New York, during the 1950s when Richard Russo was growing up there. Something, that is, besides the formaldehyde, chlorine, lime, lead, sulfuric acid, and other toxic byproducts that the town's tanneries leaked out daily. But one day, a droplet of mead must have fallen into the local reservoir, and Russo gulped it down, because boy, does he have the poet's gift. In a paragraph or even a phrase, Russo can summon up a whole world. And the world he writes most poignantly about is that of the industrial white working class. Russo is the Bruce Springsteen of novelists. In fact, Springsteen's latest proletarian pride anthem, We Take Care of Our Own, kept playing in my head as I read Russo's latest book, a memoir called Elsewhere. Russo knows what it means to take care of your own. In Elsewhere, Russo writes with his distinctive smarts and humor about his childhood and his still conflicted class emigration from blue-collar kid to college professor and writer. Most of all, though, Elsewhere is a gorgeously nuanced memoir about his mother and Russo's own lifelong tour of duty spent lovingly and exhaustedly looking out for her. Russo's mother was an anomaly in the Gloversville of his youth. Young herself and pretty, she was separated from Russo's father and had a good office job working for GE in a nearby town. Mother and son lived in an apartment in a two-family house owned by his grandparents. As a boy, Russo remembers being happy as a clam, particularly given the sweet, just-the-two-of-us type relationship he had with his mother. In a few short sentences at the beginning of the book, he vividly summons up the compact world of the Gloversville of his childhood. In the 50s, on a Saturday afternoon, the streets downtown would be gridlocked with cars honking hellos at pedestrians. Often, when we finished what we called our weekly errands, my mother and I would stop in at Pedrick's. It was a dark, cool place, the only establishment of my youth that was air-conditioned, with a long, thin wall whose service window allowed sodas and cocktails to be passed from the often raucous bar into the more respectable restaurant. By the time I graduated from high school in 1967, you could have strafed Main Street with an automatic weapon without endangering a soul. What sucked the life out of Gloversville were some of the same vampiric forces that turned vibrant small towns into husks all over the United States in the latter half of the 20th century. The demand for gloves decreased, what factories remained skedaddled overseas, workers lost their bargaining power. In 1967, when he was 18, Russo grabbed a lifeline out in the form of an acceptance letter to the University of Arizona. But he didn't exit Gloversville alone. Sitting beside Russo in the passenger seat of his wheezing Ford Galaxy, all throughout that long cross-country drive, was his mother. She decided it was time to vamoose too. And who better to escape with than the son whom she always called her rock? Another son, understandably, would have pressed the eject button, but Russo seems to have had reserves of compassion for his anxious, insatiably dependent mother, more compassion, in fact, than he shows for himself. At the close of Elsewhere, when Russo's by now elderly mother has died, he berates himself for having flatlined on her, in latter years just going through the motions of caretaking. It's a terribly stern self-accounting and a guaranteed guilt inducer for those of us readers who are ourselves taking care of elderly parents with perhaps less graceful consistency. but the refusal to go easy on himself, to settle for the standard reassurance that he did the best that he could, is what makes Russo as penetrating a memoirist here as he is a novelist. For 35 years, Russo tells readers, he and his wife joke that they never went away anywhere for longer than it took milk to spoil. Although his mother's death has finally liberated Russo from his sentry duty, he's kept her under his watch by writing this intense memoir. It turns out that it's hard to shake off a lifetime routine of taking care of your own.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Richard Russo's new memoir, Elsewhere. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. And you can follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air and on Tumblr at nprfreshair.tumblr.com.
Now we turn to a woman who's figuring out how to close the gender gap in tech careers. Jobs in the so-called STEM fields, that's science, technology, engineering, and math, are among the fastest growing in the country. But while women make up nearly half of the college-educated workforce, they hold less than 25% of STEM jobs. And on this program and others, you often hear educators and various political leaders bemoaning that fact and talking about how to change it. Now we hear perspective from someone you might not expect. Danica McKellar started as Winnie in the 1980s family show, The Wonder Years. Here she is in the series finale, trying to break up again with Kevin, played by Fred Savage.
Kevin, here's what I think. I think this had to happen. Today, tomorrow, someday. I mean, it's not like we're kids anymore. Everybody grows up.
Well, Danica McKellar did grow up. She went on to graduate, summa cum laude, thank you very much, from UCLA with a degree in mathematics. And since then, she's written 4 math education books. Her latest is Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape. And Danica McKellar is with us now. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Now, for people who aren't familiar with the books, they are a little different from the math books that you sometimes see in the kind of the summer workbook section of your, you know, toy store or bookstore, for example. On the cover of this one, there's How Do You Attract Guys? 8 Self-Esteem Boosters, an Inside Body Image Quiz. So a little different.
Yes.
How did you get the idea for this kind of book?
Well, first of all, I was a math major and loved math and kept encountering women who would say, oh, I could never do math. I was just never good at it. And then if you talk to them longer, you find out there was one teacher or one bad experience they had that was really discouraging. And because we are surrounded by stereotypes that tell us that girls are not supposed to be as good at math, you know, when girls are inundated with that and they do have a bad experience, they tend to give up a lot faster than they would if they weren't already of the mindset of, I'm not supposed to be good at this anyway. And I just kept seeing that happen again and again. And I thought, you know, I think I can do something about this. Maybe I can be like an ambassador for math because I love math and I don't fit the stereotype of the typical person who would be good at math. And it's been really exciting. And the girls who read my books, they're now starting to grow up and I'm hearing feedback about how they decided to be math majors and how they feel confident and how they feel good about themselves. And I'm just thrilled to be a part of their journey.
Well, one of the things that you do in the books is that you make it relatable to things that girls are probably talking about or thinking about anyway. For example, in the most recent book, you use Barbie's unrealistic body measurements to explain similar shapes and ratios. Talk a little bit about that or how you got that idea.
Well, really, I'm explaining Barbie's unrealistic ratios by using the stuff that I'm teaching them, with similar triangles and proportions. And to me, it's like, well, you know what? Math is a language, first of all. That's just a true statement. It's the language of the sciences. And it is a language that you can talk about a lot of different things in. You can talk about your taxes, or you can talk about Barbie. I mean, Barbie's a little young for high schoolers, but you can talk about things that teenage girls are thinking about. Popularity, boys, I don't know, pizza, puppies, you name it. It's in the books.
What kind of response, you've already started talking about this, that you get from educators, parents, and kids? I mean, we know that kids really enjoy the books, but what about educators and parents? What are you hearing from them?
The parents are grateful. A lot of them talk about how much cheaper it is than a tutor and how much more effective it's been. I guess some of them might not have the best tutors. I don't know. Educators love it as well. The only negatives I've really gotten is I would say from administrators, some of them who are a little hesitant about the titles. Mm-hmm. You know, math doesn't suck. I would get principals emailing me and saying, I'm sure the book is very good, but we don't even allow people to wear T-shirts that have that word on it. How can we let them carry the book? And so what was happening was kids were sneaking my book into their locker at school to show their friends and to to do their math homework with. And I just thought to myself, you know what? If I'm getting kids to sneak a math book into school, I'm doing something right.
If you are just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm speaking with Danica McKellar. Now, I know you probably remember her from The Wonder Years, but we are talking about her best-selling math books. Her latest is Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape. We mentioned at the beginning of the conversation that you've always liked math, and you were never, you know, discouraged by the stereotype of, oh, girls can't do math. Oh, math is hard. I mean, where did we hear that?
Speaking of Barbie.
Well, I was going to say, but why do you think you never got kind of bitten by that discouragement bug?
It bit me a little. In the seventh grade, I actually was really afraid of math, and I would come home and I would cry because I was afraid of my math homework. I didn't realize at the time that it was just a teacher who didn't really know how to relate the material to us and explain it very clearly. Midway through the year, they brought a different teacher in, and it was amazing the difference. She made math fun and interesting and friendly. She used to have us lay down on the floor and do like a 5-minute relaxation exercise before we took our math tests. She was amazing. And her whole attitude completely changed my attitude about math. When I got to college, I did not think I would be able to handle college math. And here it is. I had taken the Calculus BC exam, the AP Calculus BC exam, and I'd gotten a 5, which is the highest score you can get. And it's the hardest AP Calculus class you can take in high school. I didn't think I'd be able to handle college math. And who did I think would be able to handle college math, if I'm really honest with myself? Somebody who didn't look like me. Probably a guy. They'd be really good at college math, right? But I wouldn't be. I don't really belong. I didn't look the part. I didn't think I'd be able to handle it. And that's the only explanation. That's the only, all those little stereotypes, all those messages, they got in and they damaged me. Thank goodness I'm stubborn and I like a challenge. So I was like, oh, I'm just going to try it anyway. I'm just going to go for it. What the heck? And for me, actually, thank goodness I got through that fear that I had, because math ended up being something that bridged me from the child star thing, which can be very hard on the self-esteem, into who I was going to end up being, which is a confident young woman who knows she's good at something hard.
I do have to ask you, though, are you ever concerned that when you're using subjects that are more girl-friendly, are you ever concerned that perhaps you're not preparing girls adequately for the fact that the profession is still very male-dominated or male-centric, if you want to put it that way? You know, it's the same question people have when girls go to a predominantly, like a single-sex academic environment, for example, or for even a historically black college or university. There are always people who will say, well, that's fine. It's nice that that was comfortable there, but the world isn't that way, and you're going to be at a disadvantage when you go into a male-dominated classroom. See what I'm saying?
This is what I would say to that. That's like telling you, that's like saying, well, when you're raising your child, you shouldn't really be very nice, and don't be fair, because you know what? The world's not fair. Like, don't give them too much love. I say build them up strong when they're young. Build them strong. I went to an all-girls middle school and high school, and it helped to make me as confident as I am. I really believe that.
Danica McKellar is an actress and math advocate and educator. Her latest book is Girls Get Curves, Geometry Takes Shape, and she joined us from NPR West in Culver City, California. Good luck to you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.